Remember the first time you saw a race car on an open trailer? Maybe it was full of dirt, tire marks, and other battle scars. You wondered where it had been, and more importantly, where it was going next. Every open trailer has a story, and we're here to tell it. Welcome to the Open Trailer Podcast. Indeed, back for stage number two of Lewis Anderson on Open Trailer Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Austin, coming off a record week with the Dirty Lou. Yes, think of all the people we've had on the show. New England Auto Racing Hall of Famers, May Motorsport Hall of Famers, icons of the sport, and not to diminish Lou's role at all in the grand scheme of local racing. He certainly has his place, and it's a pretty large one. I'm recording this on a Monday. So technically, the show's been out Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I haven't even looked at today's numbers. You know, this podcast isn't one that's, it's not a moneymaker. It's not beholden to advertising, so I don't live and die by the stream numbers. I'm more concerned with the stories and interested in those. But of course, I look. I mean, who wouldn't? And, you know, I mean, I looked on Friday morning, and it was already up to one of the three most listened to episodes of the season. And that's just the first couple days, first day, right? And then I haven't looked today, but Sunday, it's the most listened to episode we've had all year. I don't want to say it's the most listened to episode we've ever had. It will be. It's trending that way. And it doesn't happen without your support. You know, every week I say share, screenshot. It's simple. All the S words, right? And it helps so much because you putting it on your page exposes it to people who aren't familiar with the podcast. But I can't tell you how many people have reached out and said, you know, hey, my buddy told me to check this out. You know, even shout out to people who have commented on the page itself, like Nick Campbell. Awesome dude. And it blew my mind that a guy like Nick Campbell had never listened to a podcast. And he said, it's the first one I've listened to all the way through. And he was a big Lou fan, still is. So, you know, that stuff is extremely flattering. And just getting the word out really helps the podcast and just, you know, get these stories told. And that's the intention of it. As I've said many times before, the original intention of Open Trailer was to get firsthand accounts by some of the legends who lived them, the legends who built what we get to enjoy today so freely. And from there, you know, obviously we still have some to get to, but also dipping into, I wouldn't say recent history because, I mean, it's all relative. To a 30-year-old, Lewis Anderson was who they grew up with. It might have been their first favorite race car driver, or same thing with Trevor Sanborn. So even guys, you know, who made their bones or their headlines in the 90s, 2000s, 2010s, it's all relative, you know. So however it's reaching you, thank you, and continue to do all the S stuff. Share, screenshot, tell a friend. That's borrowed from Russ Conway. You know, we're going to have a fun stage too. This one, Lou tells more Lou stories in only the ways that Lou can. So we pick up where he was voted off the island. And I can't tell you how much that resonated with me. You know, and I lived it, right? I mean, a lot of us did. And at the time, it was very easy to point the finger at the man for getting himself to the point that he did. But as he described, he said, you know, yeah, I did some stuff. And yeah, some of it was my fault, but not all of it was. And to be fined for a heat race that he wasn't even in, I mean, that's ridiculous. Anyway, getting back to the point of not considering the person who was experiencing the things that we all kind of, you know, had a certain opinion of. Like, imagine being Lewis. Right. And you win your first race and everybody lines up on the pits or in the pits and high fives you, says you're great and everything. That's when they don't expect you to win. And then you come back and kick their ass a few times and you start winning multiple races during the year. And yeah, I mean, you're a rough riding guy, but that's racing. And then they want to get rid of you. They literally had a meeting. The same people's hands who touched his in congratulations of winning that race were the hands that were going up saying, get the f*** out of the racetrack. We don't want you to ever come back. I mean, imagine being in that man's shoes. It's wild. He lived an existence that few racers will ever know. You know, I mean, some will, but it's been very interesting slash rewarding to you know, hear the firsthand account from Lou, and we get more of that. We also get, you know, Lou's always been known as a hard nosed racer, and he had to be a budget minded racer. He didn't have any money. But how many people would choose paying the tire bill over the electric bill? How many people would rather sit in the dark all week but be able to go racing and have a loving partner next to them every step of the way, which is what Sarah has been. Sarah's been his constant for, geez, almost 30 years now. And they're a lovely couple, and I'm so glad that she was here to record with Lou, because she had to jog his memory a few times. Some of that you hear in the podcast as well. Lots of great stories. Thank you for the support on Patreon, patreon.com/opentrailerpodcast. $5 a month gets you the early drop. We're still working on the Thought You Should Know portion of it, which will be a revisit with former guests of like, hey, remember when you were on the podcast and you called me like 2 days later and said, I should have said this? Well, that's the opportunity to say that. That's going to be a Patreon-only thing coming down the line at some point. Also support May Motorsports Hall of Fame and May Vintage Race Car Association. They just had their Hall of Fame induction ceremony, which included former guest Bob Babb Jr. And if you want to go back and listen to Bobby's episodes, we had three generations of Babs: the late great Bob Sr., the now May Motorsport Hall of Famer Bob Jr., and his son Brad Babb. That was a really cool one. Season 2, I believe that's him. You can go back and search. But let's get to it. Lewis Anderson, Stage 2, Open Trailer Podcast. Let's go. Tell me about that infamous meeting, because I think, you know, and again, to come back to the story we were kind of painting a few minutes ago, that, you know, you embraced a role that 98-99% of people in that pit area wouldn't have done as well as you did, but it still had to bother you a little bit on the inside when you have your peers who were so happy that you won a race and were shaking your hand. They're now shaking their fist at you, and they're trying to get you kicked out of the division.
And yeah, we were on pretty thin ice with Andy. We were having meetings regularly with him and a weekly golf cart ride with Junior.
What are those golf cart rides like for those that have never taken one?
If it was a bad week the week before, they weren't good. But if it was a good week the week before, then he would tell you it was a good week.
So you were on probation.
Oh, yeah.
So you had the mandatory golf cart ride every week?
Every week.
Wow.
Yeah.
What were some of the things that he, Junior, would talk about if, it, say, it wasn't the best week?
They've always taken a practice away for my penalty if I had a bad week.
Wait a minute. So they want you to improve, so your punishment is to drive less?
Yeah.
That makes no sense.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
And, yes, there were a lot of guys that wouldn't put up with what I did, I'm sure. A lot of guys have come and gone from that racetrack, but obviously we were there when the Wildcats began, when there were four divisions of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there till the last day. They had Wildcats, so
yeah.
Not many guys can say they did that.
But that meeting where they closed the garage door,
yeah.
What was that room like that day?
Oh, it was everybody against me at that point in time. They took a vote, and everybody but one voted against me.
And what did they vote for?
Initially, they voted for me to not race ever there.
They kick you out of the track for good.
Yeah. Initially, that was the plan. Then,
were these your friends? People that you considered your friends?
Some of them.
What'd that feel like inside?
I wasn't happy about it. That was obvious, because I do feel I took way too much of the blame for more of the accidents. The accidents weren't 100% my fault. Some were. I get that.
Hmm.
But I do feel I was unjustly blamed for a lot of stuff that happened, and because I got fined for a wreck, for wrecking a guy, and we weren't in the same heat race.
I'm sorry to laugh, but You say, can you just say that one more time? I want this to sink in to the listener. What happened to you again?
That year I got fined for wrecking a guy in a heat race, and we weren't in the same heat race.
You wrecked a guy in a heat race that you weren't even in.
Yeah.
At least the fine says so.
That's what the fine said.
Wow.
And I was told to pay it because I missed one somewhere along the line.
That's wild.
But our penalty was to start last in every heat and feature for the rest of the 13 season. And going into the last night, we were leading the points until we had a cut tire in the feature.
Hmm. So what did they eventually settle on? They didn't kick you out of the track for good, obviously. Your best days were ahead of you.
It's that last heat and feature.
Okay, so that was it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was like 3/4 of the season. We had that last heat and feature. And back then, that's when they started letting you have the position you passed in the heat.
Yeah.
And shot the feature in that spot. And yeah, I had to start last every time.
So even if you started last in the heat race and you started, 10th or 9th and you finished 4th, you'd still have to start 20th in the feature. Wow. Yeah. Do you think that cost you the championship?
No, because we had the lead going into the last night.
Right, but when you add up all the points over the course of 17 weeks.
I'm sure it could have.
Yeah. So you could be a 2-time champion. If that meeting hadn't happened.
As far as state champions from NASCAR go, I am.
Oh, right, because
NASCAR doesn't take away the point. Because I was fined 60 points and penalties in 2013. So because NASCAR doesn't recognize them track penalties, I get the state championship in 2013.
Wow. I'd forgotten about that.
But Andy doesn't recognize anybody but the Pro Start champion in Division I.
That's probably why I didn't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Yeah, because that was never in my folder, that you were the state NASCAR champion. And how does that work again? Like, I'm all hindsight 2020. Refresh my memory on, because all I pay attention to, because that was what was in my sheet,
right,
is, I guess that year was probably Mike Rowe was the champion. Mike Rowe or...
It must have been Rowe because it was the Fowler car, because the trophies were green that year at the champion at the banquet for the Fowler car. So either Mike Rowe or... Must have been Mike Rowe.
Yeah, Rowe drove... Pretty much, yeah, I think, from 2009.
No.
I mean, I could go look it up.
No, 13, yeah, 13, I don't remember, because the champion in 16, when I was the champion, was Curtis Gary.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was just thinking of. Nope. So, yeah, it could have been Mike Rowe, yeah.
Curtis Gary, now there's a guy that's a lot like you in the sense where he struggled for, because you guys actually started right around the same time, if I remember right. He started in the mid-80s.
He did, because I remember watching him. And he struggled with the Pro Stocks.
Yeah, and Modifieds.
And, yeah, the Modifieds.
But by 2016, you're both champions.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting footnote. I hadn't put that together until just now. Because Curtis Gary, people who've watched racing in the last 10 years just know him as, the 7G.
Yeah.
But there was a big change in his career. Do you need to get a drink of water or anything?
I'm good.
Bathroom?
Yeah. I'm all set.
Okay. Yeah, there was a big change in his career where he got that new race car, and then he was just lights out great.
It was amazing to watch that car.
Yeah, 7th, 8th place driver consistently, and then he goes out and wins a bunch of races, and then you do the exact same thing. Tell me about your – wait a minute. Didn't you race 1 year in Limited Sportsman Super Sport? Not Super Sportsman.
It was in 2002.
Sports Series.
I raced Sports Series 2002.
Yes. Tell me about that year that you raced the Sports Series, which was the 1 year that you weren't a Wildcat driver.
Yeah. 2001, we destroyed the car opening day. We bought one Sunday afternoon race. We bought one Sunday night. Finished out 2001 season. And then for some reason, we thought going Sports Series was a good idea when we couldn't afford a Wildcat. We had an Usman car. We had it at the car shows and about power plants in that one. I think we lost 6 engines that year.
And where is this? Is this coming out of your shop?
We were running out of Keith Emery's garage that year in Buxton.
How tight were finances?
Extremely.
In those years?
The early days, we'd come home on Monday and find the lights turned off because we didn't pay the power bills. We went racing. We would definitely, if people raced on our budget, they win the race. Because if we had $20 extra, we went racing. If we didn't have $20 extra, we went racing.
And you're raising how many girls at this point?
This is before we had the girls. It was that bad. Oh. It was like that. Once the girls came along, we made sure the bills were paid and all that. We figured out that singing in the dark all week wasn't the hot setup.
Wait a minute. So you would literally sit in the dark with the lights out because you wanted to go racing?
Yep. Yeah.
Sarah just said that she would have to wait until the next paycheck to pay the CMP bill.
We did that. Her and I did that all the time before the kids were born.
What would you rather?
All the time. We had 1 year before the kids were born.
What year? What bill would be paid first, the CMP bill or the tire bill?
We weren't buying tires.
Right.
There was no tire rule, so we were getting used takeoffs from whichever Wildcat driver threw one away in the tire pile that week.
Hmm. So there's one story that that sticks out in my memory, and I've never heard the firsthand account of it from both parties. And it was the night that involves an alternator and a passenger vehicle, and not yours, your partner Sarah's. Sarah, can you take my chair here and tell us that story?
Lewis and I owned
the Buick Regal.
The Buick Regal.
The one I made a race car out of. What happened is we broke in practice. I can't remember what we broke. The Buick Regal that we made a race car out of eventually was in the parking lot. And when she came over after the races, the vehicle was parked beside the trailer. And she wanted to know why her car was in the pits because we robbed parts off it to go racing.
Yeah, I was freaking out because I went to get in the car to drive the car over to the pits, and the car wasn't where I was where I'd parked it.
You thought someone stole your car?
Yeah, because back then, when I first started with Lou, we never took keys out of the car. We'd just leave the keys in the car and go do what we were going to do, and then we'd come back, get in the car, and go home. We'd be at the mall, out to eat, whatever. So when the races were over, the kids and I are walking over to get in the car so we can go over to the pits and see Dad and, congratulate him, just hang out like we did after the races and stuff. And car wasn't where the car was. So back then, we didn't have a cell phone or anything. So I'm like, okay, so I guess we're hoofing it. So we would sit in the grandstands, and anybody that's been at Beech Ridge, you pretty much can just walk around the fence and you can just get right into the pits. Mm-hmm. So the kids and I would walk around. I had a baby carrier I was carrying, and I had Danielle and Megan that year. So I had two little toddlers that were walking beside me going into the pits. I get in the pits, the kids run to go see Dad, and I'm like, okay, why is the car in the pits? He goes, well, fried up some spark plug wires and needed them so that we could go racing. And I'm like, oh. I'm like, beautiful. So then we spent the last half hour, 20 minutes, him trying to finagle putting the car back together just so that I could take the kids home.
Wow. That's commitment.
One year, I don't remember.
Took the carburetor off the truck 1 year.
Yeah, he took the carburetor off the truck 1 year.
Distributor.
Yeah, so we owned a 97 Chevy GMC Sierra. That's what we towed that's what we towed the race car to, the track. And I would go in the pits after the races one night, and the hood's up on the truck. I was shaking my head, and I'm like, okay, so how long is it going to take to put the truck back together so that we can go home? He goes, oh, no time whatsoever. And you look in the hood, spark plug wires are out, the distributor's out, everything. So basically, he loads the race car on the trailer, starts disassembling the race car so that he can reassemble the truck so that him and I can go home for the night. Jeez. That's how tight money was back then, that you just robbed Peter to pay Paul, basically, and then hoped that you could put Paul back together to be able to get through the work week the following week.
What keeps you tied together during this time?
Stupidity.
You say it loud on the microphone. That's fine. It's
Sometimes it's stupidity. Sometimes, I don't know, we just fit. Somehow the two of us just fit. We can butt heads as much as we want to, lose patience with one another, but at the end of the day, somehow we come back and we are like best friends.
All right, so how long you guys been together?
27 years.
What is the, let me put Lewis on the spot, what is the biggest key to a successful relationship?
Just got to both be happy and It's not as easy as that. It's not as easy as it says, saying it, that's for sure. But you just got to have both parties be happy with the way things are going, and or at least get the ship headed the direction that both parties will be happy, because, as you know, the road's rough and you get off track once in a while.
Especially when the lights aren't on.
Especially.
You know, one of the biggest things that happened in your racing career, you had that season where you won three races in 2013. You won the Wildcat 50, you know, when you couldn't even qualify for it back in the day. So that's a, you know, that's an amazing accomplishment in its own right. But you still didn't have that championship.
Never, I was told by track employees that as long as I was with Randy Hammond, I'd never win a championship.
Why is that?
I don't know. That's what I was told by unnamed sources.
Mm.
But, yeah, I would never win a championship. And 2015, I got a job doing concrete work, foundations. And the money was good, real good money. And we just kept putting stuff, more money in the car, and buying the better parts, buying better this, better that. 2015, we finished, I don't know, fourth or fifth in the points, maybe sixth in the points.
Yeah, you're up there in the top five, but your championship year is still ahead of you.
Yeah, and so that was the year we decided to go down to Pensacola in the winter of 15. Went to December of 15, we went down to Snowball Derby.
What possessed you to do that?
Steve Perry again, another Steve Perry story. We've been down there for years watching it, and he goes, we need to bring you down here and race it. So somehow he mustered up enough sponsorship money that we went down there and raced it.
That was your bad Santa car, wasn't it?
That was the bad Santa car, because I left a wrap on it for that the following season.
Yeah. So for those, I think it actually made national news.
It did. We had to go and meet...
Santa Claus?
Nope. we had something in North Carolina at who's... Interview? We did an interview with like Speed 51, I think it was.
Oh, okay.
We had stopped by Speed 51 and do that. But yes, we made the news because our car was at the hotel in North Carolina for a week. Well, for a couple of days, because we said we're going to go down to Florida. We need to take a break and then tour the NASCAR shots, because that time we'd only been to a couple of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy that hauled my car down the first year was David Turner, and he hadn't been to any of them. So we went to NASCAR Hall of Fame.
Yeah,
we had a condo down on the beach and all that.
So you did it upright.
We did it upright the first year and spent a lot of money doing it.
And you did it on an open trailer, too.
Yeah, we went down an open trailer in the rain.
So you get to your destination. You know, you're among $100,000 haulers.
Yeah.
Chase Elliott and his tungsten, probably. That might have been a few years prior.
No, that was it. That was either the first or second year we were there.
Yeah. I mean, you're among big money.
Absolutely.
The biggest pool you've ever swam in.
Mm-hmm.
And you drive in with your open trailer. Tell me what that moment was like.
We got down there to track. We had to be on the infield Thursday morning. But we got down to the track Tuesday afternoon. And just to check stuff out. And the owner, Tim Bryan of Five Flag Speedway, saw us pulling the driveway, and he goes, these must be the guys from Maine, because then he saw our truck and pulled the plates, and he gave us a big tour of the facility and everything like that. So he's right out in the parking lot working on stuff. He stopped what he was doing to come over and greet us.
That's awesome.
The first year, yeah. The Bryan family was awesome down there. Any year that we had an issue, they have a parts trailer, a parts garage on the infield, so they helped us get what we needed to get, and...
Mm-hmm.
If they couldn't get it, they knew where to get it from. That the Bryant family was amazing the 3 years we did that down there.
Tell me about being on that relatively larger track than compared to Beech Ridge. What was it like to get out there, you know, guy from Hollis now, out there at Five Flags?
The speed is incredible. And then you got to slow the car down, and you're on a 790 Hoosier tire, which they're running at Oxford and Wiscasset, and actually all of New Hampshire. Most of New Hampshire tracks are running it too. And so it was a pretty skinny tire, and that was, we had the wrong gear in it the first year down there. So we were literally floating the valves at the start-finish line. We had too much gear in it. But so we ended up finishing sixth, and we were vying for a top five spot until we had contact with a guy, and we saved it so we didn't hit the wall or anything like that. But
You were the guy that I bought the pay-per-view for. I didn't. I bought the whole pay-per-view not to watch the Snowball Derby, but to watch you a race that was a is it Wednesday or Thursday night?
Thursday night, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the first year, the first couple of years, Sarah went down with us, and then the, but Matt Dow and the whole North Coast Transit crew, they all did the pay-per-view at Matt's house mm-hmm. for Thursday night.
Yeah.
We could care less about the rest of the weekend.
Yeah, same here. It was great to root you on. But yeah, the bad Santa car catapults you into a place that you hadn't been before, which is A, the national spotlight, and then B, you come back to Beechridge, and I believe that was your championship year.
It was, and what we attribute it to is that, yeah, it was a the car was all done. We weren't at the last second scrambling on in April to finish it or in making sure everything was right because we'd already raced it in December and went to the car shows with it and all that.
Yeah, you weren't beating up Sarah Sierra to, you know, just to make the race.
Nope.
Yeah. And the lights were on 24 hours a day.
They were. Yeah.
Yep. Cole Watson and Matt Game were your main rivals that year.
Had been for several years.
Yeah. Yeah. But that year, I mean, they've been on the podcast and they explained their side of what had happened with, I don't know if it was Mike. Well, I think Ramsey ended up involved in it somehow. But tell me about your side of that year.
We were having a really good season. We'd picked up a win sometime in the midsummer, either June or July. So we were right there with the points for a while. And then we'd fallen back to like fifth or something like that at one point. And the car wasn't going right. And with two races to go, Randy Harmon, it was Thursday night in the garage. I remember it plain as day. He asked me what I was doing tomorrow at work. And I said, we're loading up forms because we're all done the foundation. We've got to strip the foundation, load the forms, and go to our next job site.
Oh, are you putting pools in for Randy?
No, I wasn't.
Oh, okay.
I had before, but now I was working for concrete.
Okay.
And he goes, need to take the day off from work. I'm like, okay. So I called the foreman, told him I wasn't going to be in Monday, and I had the truck.
Friday.
I'm going to be on the truck on Friday. I'm going to be to work on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
I had the 1 ton for the work because I was the only one with the driver's license on the crew. So the foreman came and got it, and he drove without his license and this and the other thing, which is the normal requirements for them guys.
Yeah.
And so I show up at the garage my Friday morning, and Randy's not around. He's out doing something, I'm not sure what. Didn't matter. At 11 o'clock, he tells me to take the motor out of the car. This is Friday morning. Okay. Took the motor out, took transmission out. And he starts with the Sawzall on the frame. Cuts the frame right off it. Cuts the clip right off the car. Friday morning.
Yeah, you got a race tomorrow.
Yeah. We're racing in 24 hours. And I'm like, okay. So we went out back. We had another car out back, cut the clip off that one, brought it in. So, well, 2 o'clock Friday afternoon, I'm putting the motor back in, the front suspension back on. And he said something didn't look right to him when he measured it. And he was looking at it. He couldn't figure out what was wrong, but the car wasn't fast. And we were running 18 threes, which was an average Wildcat time. Wasn't great. And we clipped Chaz's car the week before, and he was running 17-second bracket. So I'm like, okay. And I went out, and Chaz and I were both down to 17 sevens in practice.
Wow.
And then we came from behind to win the last two features in a heat to win the championship.
And what was that moment like where you crossed the line and you knew that you were a NASCAR champion?
I didn't know. Because they had the accident on the front straightaway with Cole and Chaz and a few others. I don't know who was involved. And everybody says they were taking Cole out. I never heard anything about that. And neither did Chaz and them guys. But whatever, that's what they want to think.
So Sarah's provided a little bit of off-mic perspective on this. And the confusion that was going on in that race, where the way the tow truck driver or the way the tow trucks were positioned.
I see there was an accident, and I saw Cole and Chaz were involved, but I didn't know to what extent.
Right. So you didn't know.
And then when they red flagged us on the back straightaway, and I'm standing outside Christina Nadu. Well, she's on my inside, and I'm on her outside, just sort of like halfway up on her calf. So I'm like looking at the B post of her calf, the C post of her calf, the back of it, and the back of the roof. And they were on the back stretch, and they were hauled Cole's car by me, and I said, oh, they need a radiator for it. They'll be right back out. So until Dan Walker, I put my flag up with Dan Walker in turn three. I had no idea I won the championship. I know I did what I needed to do, but Cole, all he had to do was finish seventh or higher or something like that, and he had the championship. So, because he had a big lead going into the feature.
Yeah.
Or a decent-sized lead going into the feature.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, in my Rain Man.
14 points.
Yes, in my Rain Man mind, it's 14 points.
Something like that.
So basically, he basically went into the race saying, there's no way I can win the championship. He goes, but maybe we can go out and we can at least win one final race for the season. So in his head, he was thinking, I want to win this race, but Cole's already got the championship.
So can you just repeat that a little bit, Lewis?
Yeah, like she was saying, Cole had the championship wrapped up for the most part because he was, with 2 weeks to go, he was 40-something points ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just going out there and just going to achieve as many points as possible. So out of 60 in night, I scored 60 and 59 the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, out of a possible
120, I scored 119.
Yeah.
And I don't remember the bonus points that year or not. I don't remember if that was a year of them or not, but don't think so.
No, I think they came a little bit after, so it was like 3 points for the feature win.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's any bonus points involved. So, but like I say, I couldn't tell how bad their cars were when they were towed to the pits, so I had no idea. I just knew I had to win the race.
So at that moment, when you saw the car towed in, you were like, it's still not my championship to lose.
Right. I had no idea. I was just driving my race, and the car was fast, like the last two races after changing the clip. And then, I don't know, I just did what I had to do. And I didn't have to wreck anybody, because Turtle's car will get the lead at one point. He broke. And so I'm like, all right. And I got the lead finally, and I don't even remember how much I won by. I had to win the race. And
right.
Like I said, I got down to Dan Walker and I said, did I win the championship? He goes, yeah, Cole wrecked. I said, where did he finish? He goes, he didn't. And that was when I finally found out that I won the championship.
What's that feeling like, the you know, for the guy that went to Beech Ridge in 1971 to watch his dad, the guy who was switching out plug wires from his wife's car to, you know, just to continue to the nights where the lights weren't on in your house because you wanted to go racing? What is that moment like when it sinks into you and Dan Walker utters those words, you're the champion?
I am just in utter shock because, yes, everybody dreams of winning a championship, and that was never until 2013 when I finished second, and then I had a third in 17. And championship. I didn't think getting the championship was possible for us because we just didn't have the equipment to compete with everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was in my mind that, yeah, championship's great. Winning races is what I needed to do because I hadn't even done that. I mean, I only ended up with, 14 career winnings at Beech Ridge. That was it. And
that's more than a lot of people, though.
It is more than a lot of people, but not many people have a 37-year career there either.
Mm. Yeah.
Whatever it was. I don't remember now what year we stopped, 21?
Yeah, I mean, that's another point, too. I mean, you know, you get that championship, and it's such a fulfilling moment. And then, you know, you pick up some wins here and there over the course of time. I think you tried out racing at Lee 1 year.
19, we went to Lee 1 year. And I don't remember why.
Yeah.
But we just decided to go to Lee 1 year. And we had a lot of okay races down there, pretty decent races down there for us, actually.
Mm.
New track to us, and we were sitting third in the points with two races to go, and we had a shot at second. Albie had the championship sold up that year. Pretty sure it was Albie we were racing against.
Yeah, because, you know, it's funny, you competed with him in the years he was running the 35 car up here,
yeah,
and then you go to a different track, and boom, there's Albie Ovitt.
Yeah, and he was always fast, and it was just nice to be able to compete with him, and we did decent down there, and we did really good down there, and we ended up finishing, I think, sixth in points because we missed the last two races of the season because I was in the hospital. I had a stroke.
Can you tell us a little bit about any warning signs, what that moment was like for you?
It was really weird the way it felt. I felt all week, and it's hard to describe. I still, to this day, can't describe what I was feeling. It was like...
So if you felt those feelings again, you wouldn't know that a stroke is coming.
I feel them all the time now, so I'm paranoid about it, but nothing's succumbed of it. I was sick feeling all week, but I went to work all week.
Just fatigue or nauseous?
Both.
Okay.
My head was really clouded, like I was hungover and I hadn't been drinking. Then Friday I woke up and I'm like, oh, I feel pretty good Friday. So I went to work half a day like I usually do. And then we went and raced at Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And we got in a minor accident down there. We sailed it down in the corner and lost the brakes. I spun it out. So I missed a wall, and a guy hit us, and all it did was wreck the radiator and the bumper. So the frame wasn't damaged at all. So Sunday, I woke up like, I don't feel good. Again, on Saturday or Sunday, I didn't feel good. And I blamed some of that on the accident, but it wasn't like I got hit that hard. I mean, when the guy hit me, I was rolling backwards, so wasn't like stopped.
The G-forces, yeah, the G-forces were in your, weren't there. Yeah, they were in your favor.
Absolutely. And so Saturday we went to Beach Ridge. Sunday, I said, we got to get up. We got to go fix her car so she can go to work with it. We have down to one vehicle. And she said, well, we got to go to, her and Nicole went to Walmart. Might want to go to Walmart. I said, well, my car's at the soccer shop for Steve Perry because we hauled it to Saturday night, Friday night. So I'm going to go down there and take the radiator out, see what we need to fix it. That's all I'm going to do. Just take it apart, see what we need to fix it. We didn't have... we didn't have money for radiator, so I had no idea we were going to get a radiator from it, on the way down to Saco, I passed out at my daughter's car, and I am sitting in an air-conditioned car with all the vents blowing on me, which I never do because I'm always cold, and I am sweating profusely, and then I passed out, and she shook me from, she was in the back seat, because I was riding in front with Nicole. Nicole was driving her car. And literally, we're on Industrial Park Road in Saco. So in 5 more minutes, I'd have been alone for 5-6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And they ran me over to the Quick Care on Route 1 on Ross Road. And I didn't even get checked in there. They called the ambulance from Saco, and they rushed me to Maine Medical Center and said I had a blood clot on my head, on my brain, and a stroke. And I'd lost all feeling in my left side of my body. And I could walk, but it was like my leg was asleep at all times. So I had to pay attention to whether I was actually taking a step with it or not. And my left arm, I had reduced feeling in, no feeling in at that time. And the left side of my face was all numb.
Did you feel that you would ever come back from that?
Talking to the doctors, we had no idea. Some come back, some don't come back. And it's been 11 years now.
Well, no, it's been four
years now. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, been 4 years, and I still have no feeling in my left thumb or couple of fingers. They're always numb, and grasping things with my left hand is an issue. Always dropping things now, and when I get really, really tired, lifting my left leg is a task in itself sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we started the 2020. In 2020, in January, we started building this new car we have. And they asked me who's going to drive it because I'm hobbling around the shop in January, and I don't know who's going to drive it. Hopefully me. And I was able to get clearance to go back to work and drive and all that. And I tried driving it and didn't have any major issues with driving.
How nervous were you the first time you got behind the wheel?
Real nervous. Because I wasn't sure what to expect, and I'd done it before, but I wasn't sure if I could still do it.
Yeah, you didn't have a known stroke before that.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so then we ended up pulling off, that was the COVID year, we only had 5 or 6 races at Beach Ridge, and I did pull off one of the wins.
Did.
That was the last win I got at Beach Ridge.
Yeah, and no one ever knows that it's going to be their last win unless they have a retirement plan put out.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that day? Coming back after having the stroke, still having a compromised body, and still competing at a pretty high level. What was that moment like for you to get that checkered flag?
That was amazing because Chaz Briggs and I had raced side by side for 40 something laps doing crossover moves left and right on each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we touched twice in 40 laps, the side by side competition. He had won that race. It wasn't for the lap car coming out of the pits. And the lap car slid up. So, and I had the bottom on getting into one, and he ran into the back of it.
Yeah.
So if it wasn't for that, Chaz would have won that race, and I wouldn't have that nice looking trophy. And then they gave us some placard flags because they didn't have anybody sewing flags together.
Hmm.
So.
But still, I mean, inside, when you got out of that race car.
That was amazing because I wasn't sure I could even drive it in April, and here I am in August with a win.
Hmm. Was your family in Victory Lane with you that day?
I don't remember. I don't think they were, because I don't think anybody was in Victory Lane with that picture. Nope.
No.
I don't remember doing Victory Lane pictures at all with that one.
Yeah. That's all right. Yeah, because it was COVID year, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, because COVID, we weren't doing Victory Lane photos because obvious reasons.
Yeah.
It would look weird, you know.
Have everybody together down in the Victory Lane.
Yeah, we were supposed to be 6 feet apart. It makes for a very wide lens.
I know we were all
yeah.
there, though.
Yeah.
And like I said, there's no Victory Lane photos with that one at all.
Hmm.
And no photos with the win anywhere, I don't think.
What about the night Beach Ridge announced its closure? Where were you?
On the front stretch, right with you.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was working on Chaz's car at the end of the season for whatever reason. And I was just parked for some reason. I don't remember why.
I think it's neat that your teammates, well, you were quasi-teammates and your friends.
Yeah.
But you have consecutive numbers, and that's just by accident. Because he was an 82, I think, before... Wasn't he in 82?
No,
he was 88.
88 in the track.
Because he was the field.
When he called up Beach Ridge from the garage the year he bought my old car, he saw 81 in the garage, so he said it might as well be 82.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but he was 88 before, I think, because he bought Betsy Fields' truck.
Betsy's truck, right.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. I don't know. I think it's cool. It's a cool little note.
It is.
Yeah. So anyway, getting back to Beach Ridge that night, you were helping Chaz.
Yeah. And we were all just taken aback by it. We had a driver's meeting, and it was weird because they made Mike Field the head tech director and all that stuff in the pit area.
They were promoting the night that the track was closed?
Yeah.
Wow.
And they had that in our driver's meeting before the beginning of the night.
Yeah, Mike Field, new tech director.
Yeah.
3 hours later.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, like nobody knew about anything that was going on. It was all top secret.
Yeah.
Very top secret, apparently.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously it's been well documented on the podcast, but what was that information, when that information was being delivered through your brain, what was going through it?
It's really tough to tell because we were all in just utter awe, and we were all looking at each other like, did he just say that? Mm. Like, nobody wanted to believe it, and we're all like, well, maybe somebody will come through and do something differently and sell the track to somebody else.
Mm.
And but now I don't know if it's the way it worked or not, but in my sight, looking at hindsight being 2020, some of the improvements around the track stopped happening.
Yeah.
They weren't the flowers they used to be on the infield. The grass was mowed, but the walls weren't painted week in and week out with sponsors. I tried buying a cement pad in the pits, and Andy told me to hold off on that. We wanted to wait on that and see what's going on first.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a bunch of red.
Yeah. Leading up to it now, you think about it. But
that track is painted with red flags.
It is now.
Yeah.
Now you look back on it.
Yeah, it's like a bad relationship. I'm glad it happened. Obviously, we wouldn't have this podcast. We wouldn't have you as a guest. You wouldn't have nearly the platform that you had over the course of your 37 years of racing at the racetrack. You know, I'm sure you could have raced somewhere else, but still, you know, that place was home.
Right.
That place was
11 miles from home.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what sucks about being, you know, I mean, I love the opportunities that have happened as a result of the time I spent at that racetrack, but boy, does it stink to drive 5 hours to a place to do the same job you did, you know,
that 20 minutes from home.
20 minutes from home.
Absolutely.
But you do work. We ran into each other just last week, which is kind of the seed that was planted for having you on. I always wanted to have you on. but I just saw the opportunity. I was like, oh, this is the perfect time for it. Because we were together at Richmond Karting Speedway, or excuse me, LST Motorsports Park last week, where you play a pretty crucial role in developing a new generation of talent. Can you tell me about what you do?
Yeah. Obviously, another one of Steve Perry's adventures, and nice step up and say, whatever you need help with, I'll help you with. Mm. And last year I was, well, we need a flyer for turn three. That way these kids can get slowed down and not have the major wreck, because right. we're dealing with anywhere from 5 years old up. And so, yeah, I've been the backstretch turn three flag guy for the last 2 years.
Yeah. But I think you play a coach role to those kids as well.
And yes, Lou. I got to relay if they're going too fast on the yellow or if the starts weren't quite right.
Mm.
And so, yeah, you got to also remember that these kids are 5 years old, 7 years old, so you don't want to be really harsh on them. But
yeah, you don't have any sons, do you?
I do not.
So do you see any Lewis Andersons on the racetrack, little Lews, like in the soul anyway, as far as their driving?
I'm sure there's some out there, but right now I didn't drive at that age, so these kids are already way ahead of me.
Right. But I mean, do you see someone that you see yourself in driving wise?
No. I'm sure there's somebody out there if we looked, but I haven't really found one yet.
Yeah. So, I mean, so racing's pretty much over for you. Do you ever plan to drive again?
I've been driving this year part-time. This year we did a list of tracks on the R&R Tour in New Hampshire. It's Jimmy Renfro's tour, Open Street Stock Tour.
Hmm.
We're all classed in it, but once again, I'm racing now because I like to race. I love the race, and if I win, that's excellent, awesome, great. But I'm just there to... Right now, this year I did three tracks I'd never done before.
Hmm.
So I'm just checking tracks off the bucket list because I don't know when the end's going to come. And after having a stroke, I'm not putting anything off any longer than I have to. So I went and hit tracks in New Hampshire. I went and hit tracks like I went to Thunder Road in Barrie, Vermont for an hour-and-hour race. And 3-hour drive, just her and I, just like the old days. Nobody there. With 2 hours late, we get there. We miss practice. First practice, wrecking second practice, and then we just, we weren't prepared for it, but we just ran tracked on the bucket list this year. So I don't know what next year's going to hold. We haven't figured that out yet.
One of your daughters is really crucial to you racing at least once every year. Can you tell that story?
Sarah's oldest daughter, my second oldest, is Danielle. She's been in the pit since she was 14 years old. And I told her that as long as she went and got her paperwork done before Saturday, because I didn't have time to do it on Saturday, that I'd pay her way in the pits until she was 18, which actually I paid her way in the pits until we got done racing.
Hmm.
But she was my tire girl. She kept track of the serial numbers that Beatridge wanted for any tire slips. She'd take right down tire sizes and rear pressures and all that stuff.
Wow.
Tire car.
Oh, and then we had tires in the impound trailer. She'd go get mine and Travis' tires because it was a two-tier tire rack. Then she'd go get Ryan Phillips and Matt Dow's tires and bring them for them too.
Hmm.
Yeah, she was so the tire cat weighed more than she did.
She's very crucial in you racing every single year. Where she wants you to race at least once a year, so you can say you've done it in X amount of consecutive years.
Yeah, she does. She goes to the garage before she got this job at Hannaford and met a boy. She was in the garage every night of the week with us.
Mm.
And we had anything from hammering out dents to polishing the race car and vacuuming it out. She did it all. So she was very good in the pit, in the garage area, in the garage and at the track for us.
When you look back at 1971, you're sitting in the grandstands, you're rooting for Bob Babb, you're rooting for Bob, well, not Randall at that point, but all the guys that you did. We're sitting here in 2023 and you look back on your Wildcat Championship, your big Wildcat 50, you've been all these other racetracks the last couple of years. You came back from a stroke and won a race. Could you have imagined the life that you have had as a race car driver?
Absolutely not. And yes, it was tough times, but I wouldn't change any of it. And in 2019, when I had my stroke, we got the sixth place trophy at the awards banquet, the league banquet. They also gave me the Hard Luck Award. And then,
well, no one's going to beat that.
Right. Yeah. And then when I came back in 2020 and won the race at the Auburn Mall Show, the Emerson family gave me, in honor of Larry passing away, the Perseverance Award for the comeback with that and all that. And them two awards mean a lot to me. Then we got the first 5,000 to win race they had at Lee. We finished second to Jimmy Renfro in 26-lap race because it got shortened because of time constraints. And that $1,000 for second place, everybody's complaining about it, but that's my biggest payday ever, so I was more than happy with second.
You keep the lights on all year.
Absolutely.
Again, thank you to Lewis for just, I mean, he couldn't be anything but him. Right? And none of those stories would have sounded the same if we told them. Even if he told us and we told them back to a public, we wouldn't have had that authenticity. So thank you to Lou and his partner Sarah Dexter for just being here on a Saturday morning and killing it. Next time out, this guy is one of the most visible human beings in Maine racing the last 25, 30 years. He's done so much, from car ownership to racetrack ownership, to the TV show, to all sorts of shenanigans in between, which I can't wait to unpack with the one and only Steve Perry.
The whole field's clustered. Now Mietta's back up in top 10, because a lot of cars went scattering, you know. And Donnie's father says, "We come here to win races." I go, "Pal, anybody can come here and win races. I can give you a whole list of people who won races. There's a short list of guys that have won the championships in this late model division, you know?" So it was at that point that I made my decision right then that I was making a driver change at the end of the year.
Next time out on Open Trailer Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Austin. Thank you for the support, and talk to you next time.